This week in KMA Land, Iowa legislature approves property tax bill in final days. KMA Land lawmakers react to property tax bill's passage. Lewis Central School Board hears Save a Seat for Hayden petition discussion. Red Oak officials troubleshoot Highway 48 bridge issues. And Iowa Democratic Senate candidates square off in debate. I'm Mike Peterson. After almost 5 months and a 36-hour final session, the 2026 Iowa General Assembly is over. The Iowa House completed its work at 6:11 p.m. Sunday.
The ayes appear to have it. The ayes do have it. The House is signed to die at 91st General Assembly.
The Iowa Senate ended its 2026 session almost an hour later. Before calling it a year, lawmakers approved a plan they say will reduce property taxes for Iowa homeowners by about $4 billion over the next 6 years. Senator Dan Dawson, a Republican from Council Bluffs, is chairman of the Senate Ways and Means Committee.
This General Assembly came here with a purpose, and the unified purpose with the Iowa Governor, the Iowa House, and the Iowa Senate was to provide property tax relief for Iowans. Today, we deliver on that promise.
Iowa homeowners will get a homestead tax exemption of up to $20,000, and the plan shifts $175 million in state funding to public schools. That move will also reduce taxes in all classes of property. There is a 2% limit on annual property tax revenue growth in cities and counties. We'll talk more about that later. Republican Representative Carter Nordman of Dallas Center is chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee.
This is significant reform that delivers real, tangible relief and certainty for the Iowa taxpayer.
All but one Democrat in the Senate supported the plan, but a couple of Republicans and 20 Democrats in the House voted against it. House Democratic Leader Brian Meyer says it's another Band-Aid and a broken property tax system. Representative Amy Winkenall, a Democrat from Hiawatha, called it a Frankenstein bill.
If you are a renter in Iowa, which 40% of Iowans are, you lose under this bill.
Winkenall says multifamily units have been taxed like single-family homes for over a decade, and the plan will gradually raise property taxes in apartments and condo buildings to 6% within 3 years. Supporters of the move say, unlike a house, multifamily buildings are owned by people who are aiming to make a profit. State Senator Mark Costello says the just-concluded session will be remembered for accomplishing that major goal of property tax reform. After negotiations between the Senate, the Iowa House, and Governor Kim Reynolds, the Imogene Republican says he's glad compromise was reached on a final version.
There was, concerns about if you put too hard of a cap on things that local governments wouldn't be able to function properly. There were, different proposals that didn't get in there necessarily that I kind of liked, but I could see why not.
Besides the property tax bill, Costello cited regulations for hydrogen drilling as another accomplishment this session.
We think that there's hydrogen down there real deep in southwest Iowa, and when you get to that, it can be pulled from a large area around you, and the laws that we have for pooling of those resources were not very good for the neighboring landowners. We got that set up to protect some of the landowner rights if that comes to fruition, and they are drilling in different places to try and find that in southwest Iowa, so that's an exciting possibility, let's say.
Another accomplishment cited by Costello was the passage of restrictions on mail-order abortion pills and the allocation of $3 million for pediatric cancer research. As in previous sessions, legislation pertaining to eminent domain usage for carbon capture pipeline projects stalled to the State House. Though the Iowa House approved provisions restricting eminent domain, no action was taken in the Senate. Count Costello, as among lawmakers, disappointed.
We just never could get where we could agree on something that we could get enough votes to get it through. I'm worried that it might turn out badly for those that don't want the pipeline going through their land. Now, it doesn't really guarantee that that's going to happen because there are lawsuits out there to make sure that it's constitutional and some efforts are still being made to find ways to get that accomplished. But I feel like that was a disappointment that we could not figure out a way to get anything done on that.
Costello, however, adds this session was less contentious on the Senate side than in previous sessions in his years in the legislature. Other KMA Land legislators recovered enough from the long weekend to dissect the property tax bill. One of the more controversial components implements a 2% cap on property tax revenue growth for cities and counties. State Representative Tom Moore says the cap will force local municipalities and school districts to sharpen their pencils in terms of budget numbers to cope with limited revenue growth.
They're not going to be able to act just on the fact that they can raise the levy and have the money to do whatever it is they want to do. And now there's going to be this hard cap, and they're going to have to sharpen their pencil to make sure their budgets work. Will there be some that will have difficulties? I'm sure there will be. But the one thing that we really heard about from the people was that they were more concerned about property tax relief than they were about services.
Well, extending the amount of time school districts may use Secure and Advanced Visions for Education or SAVE dollars, the bill shifts the amount of SAVE revenues dedicated specifically to property tax relief from 7% to 25% by 2031. The Griswold Republican says some property taxpayers were critical of the way districts were using SAVE dollars.
So many of these SAVE projects were being built for elaborate stadiums, outdoor facilities, and other things, gymnasiums and whatever. And so a lot of that, once again, was stuff that needed to be reworked on and sharpened to the pencil of the school districts on what they actually need, what they can afford, and what the SAVE provides.
State Senator Tom Shipley says the limit placed on revenue growth for cities and counties is actually a soft cap. The Nottoway Republican says the cap would not apply to paying debts or employee benefits and buying liability insurance.
There are certain things you will be able to raise your levy for to cover. One of the biggest concerns, of course, is insurance, because we all know what insurance costs are doing nothing but going up. But if you had no way to levy for that, you'd have been taking stuff right out of the services, and that money would have had to come from somewhere. So that's when you'd see a big cut back in services.
Though the bill was approved during a marathon 36-hour session ending early Sunday morning, Shipley says it's a misnomer to think the measure just came together at the end. He says negotiations on key components took place between legislative leaders and Governor Kim Reynolds for months.
You know, people talk a lot about these sessions going on and on. Decisions can't be made very well, but all the big heavy lift stuff was already in process, and it was in negotiations a long time back. So it's not like it was, you know, you can't make good things happen at that hour. The good parts of it were already taken care of.
Last weekend, Mark Shipley swung song in the State House as he opted not to seek re-election after 12 years in the legislature. It's a conundrum KMA Land School officials must deal with every once in a while: how best to honor fallen students. And the Lewis Central School District is facing that unfortunate issue following a tragedy involving one of its students last fall. Back in October, 17-year-old Hayden Baker, a Lewis Central High School senior, was struck and killed by another vehicle riding a motorcycle in the 1200 block of North Broadway. More than 480 signatures were recently garnered among Lewis Central students in a Save a Seat for Hayden petition drive, calling for a seat to be placed in Hayden's memory during this month's graduation ceremonies. Hayden's mother, Carla Baker, told the Lewis Central School Board this week that after school officials originally agreed to place the chair, she was then told they could not honor her request. Instead, she says school officials agreed to place memorial flowers, Hayden's welding helmet, and a teddy bear dressed in cap and gown on the graduation stage. Carla, however, feels the chair would honor her son's achievements rather than memorialize him or take attention away from other students.
I do not want to take away from other students. As you have heard from me today, this shows the need for a policy to be put in place for special circumstances like my own, so no other grieving parents, students, and families that have to go through the battles like we have this last year, especially in the time of grief.
Lewis Central senior Emma Brunau initiated the student-driven petition drive. Brunau says Hayden was a mainstay of the school's fledgling welding program, and his importance to the program was, quote, gravely clear in his absence.
Honoring something as simple as a chair is much more than it appears. By this I mean that this is not just an empty chair. It's a visible acknowledgement of said student's absence, a tribute to their accomplishments, and a way to include them symbolically in a milestone they should have experienced. This simple gesture shows that the student's absence is felt, and that these accomplishments are recognized in a truly powerful manner.
Brunau says the petition drive also calls on the district to implement a policy to remember deceased students. Lewis Central Superintendent Dr. Brent Hazing says the district consulted officials with the National Center for School Crisis and Bereavement to determine how best to handle the situation. Hazing says the center's guidance recommends against an empty chair at graduation. While saying it's promoted by some as a way to remember a deceased student, Hazing says the chair focuses solely on the student's absence, rather than conveying anything about their contributions while alive.
As an administration, I respect you guys tremendously. You know, to stand up and do what you believe is right and to advocate for your what you believe is right, I respect that, and you guys have spoken passionately, and that passion reflects how Hayden meant, or how much Hayden meant to this community. At the same time, in moments like this, you know, it's important that we rely on established expertise to guide our decisions so that supporting all students in the most thoughtful and appropriate way as possible.
Hazing says the school's plan to recognize Hayden is consistent with previous situations involving student deaths. He adds a policy on remembering fallen students is expected to be discussed at an upcoming board meeting. Red Oak officials are dealing with an upcoming traffic disruption. Red Oak City Administrator Lisa Cotter updated the City Council Monday evening on the Iowa Department of Transportation's plans to replace the bridge spanning over Red Oak Creek on Highway 48. Plans call for work to begin Monday between 2nd Avenue and West Reed Street, with completion currently slated for November 25th. Now, the DOT is not planning to fully close the bridge. Cotter says crews are closing off the west side of the highway at the beginning of the project from 1st to Washington Avenues with barriers, which would impact the Red Oak Early Childhood Center.
So once those go up on the west side of the highway is completely closed at Washington and 1st Avenue. And then on the east side of the road, you can only go to the north because it's right only. Because if you were to have to cross to go left, you have to cross into these yellow barriers. So that means that for the first half, the daycare and the preschool are a big impact for them, because everybody right now comes on 48, gets onto Washington Street, and then disperses off to the daycare on the north side of the road.
Connor says she's reached out to the DOT about installing signage indicating that businesses in the west side of the road, including Bar, Tire, Casey's, and CarQuest, are still open.
It's a really big impact to those two businesses because people have to go south all the way to 2nd Avenue, take a westerly turn, and then come up either the alley behind Bars to get to Casey's, or on the alley to get onto West first and then come up and then go to the alleys.
Cotter says each half of the bridge would be closed for around 3 months. She adds the DOT is responsible for the rerouting of any wide roads along the project. With just weeks remaining before the June 2nd primary, the two Democrats running for U.S. Senate in Iowa squared off in a televised debate Tuesday night. State Representative Josh Turek and State Senator Zach Walls faced off on a number of issues on Iowa Press for their first planned debate ahead of the primary election. Both candidates agreed on several policies discussed during the debate, including supporting term limits, a retirement age for members of Congress, reversing tariffs implemented by the Trump administration, and raising the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour tied to inflation. But the two candidates expressed disagreements on the topic of immigration, with Walls criticizing Turek for supporting a 2024 Iowa law that made illegal immigration a state crime in Iowa and allowed state officials to carry out certain immigration law enforcement actions.
I think it was something that is not supported by law enforcement, that wasn't supported by immigrants' rights groups, and it's something that unfortunately made Iowans not more safe, but less safe. And so what I would tell the folks who are watching at home is that this is a place where there's a real disagreement in our record. And in the United States Senate, I will fight to make sure that we fix this broken immigration system, that we overhaul ICE.
Turek, whose wife is an immigrant, says Wall's accusation left out important details, including that he voted in support of the measure while former President Joe Biden was in office. The Council Bluffs Democrat added that the measure applies only to individuals who first entered the country legally and already faced a deportation order.
One, we absolutely need fundamental reforms to ICE, as the ones that I spoke about, because what we are seeing right now is inhumane and it is un-American. But two, we can also recognize that these aren't mutually exclusive ideas, that we need to have safe and secure borders, but we also need to have a far easier pathway to citizenship, including passing the Dignity Act.
In terms of what makes the ideal candidate for the general election, Turek pointed to his ability to win a state legislative seat in the reddest district won by a Democrat in the 2024 general election.
I outperformed the top of the ticket by Trump by 50% more than any other Democrat in the state. And Zach comes from a Harris plus 38 district and has never even run against a Republican. I'm battle tested. I know what it takes to win. And there's something specific about my story, my background, my resume, and my politics, focusing on prairie populism, that has a unique ability to be able to resonate with independents and moderate Republicans.
Walls, a state senator from Coralville, highlighted his willingness to take on some very difficult fights while at the State House, including some he says involved challenging other Democrats.
That is the coalition that we need to win. And it's resonating because Iowans understand that the toughest fights in Washington aren't always just about left versus right. They are about right versus wrong. And Iowans understand that it takes real courage sometimes to fight your own party. And in the Iowa legislature, I've been willing to take on people in both parties to do what I think is right. That is the courage that we need to win. That is how we're going to defeat Ashley Hinson.
The Democratic nominee would face the Republican primary winner in the November general election. Current Iowa Congresswoman Ashley Hinson and former State Senator Jim Carlin face off for the GOP nomination in June. Some KMA land counties are taking a proactive approach to the growing issue of data center construction. Recently, the Taylor County Board of Supervisors discussed forming a committee to cover mineral extraction, battery storage facilities, solar energy, and data centers. The listed projects have become a more frequent topic among even southwest Iowa counties. Mills County officials, for example, are considering a battery energy storage systems ordinance. The number of data centers in Iowa recently climbed over 100. Taylor County Supervisors Chair Jack Beggs tells KMA News their conversations in particular were sparked by a discussion at a recent multi-county meeting.
One of our relatively neighboring counties has a they have snuck in a small data center or battery storage unit on them in like connexes, so they're portable, so they can't be taxed as a permanent structure. And it just prompted us to think, okay, we need to be getting something in place to stop those before we get an ordinance in place.
Across the state line of Missouri, plans are also in the works for a new 600-megawatt AI data center in Nottoway County, developed by Scale Microgrids. In addition to helping establish regulations, Beggs says the committee's primary goal is to help protect the county's power, water quality, and water quantity.
As we all know, you know, especially data centers take huge amounts of water, and so we're just trying to get a committee together, like from some public, a couple elected officials, maybe somebody from the NRCS, maybe somebody from CERWA, and the power company. So we kind of get all sides of this.
Begg stressed the importance of having multiple perspectives at the table when discussing items such as possible data centers.
Professor is an elected official, you know, the impact of them bringing something like this into the county, whether it's going to benefit us. Of course, CERHA and maybe NRCS, just our water quality and protection of our water. Power company, you know, just get them involved because these things, if they do come in, they take huge amounts of power.
Adams County officials attended that same multi-county meeting. Adams County Supervisors Chair Chris Standley says the board is working to weigh all of the aspects and impacts of a potential data center in the county.
Just trying to weigh the pros and cons and just the capacities that our counties have to support them as far as resources that it takes. And, you know, there's limited water and electrical and resources to support those projects, and also just the effects that they have on communities. And
Standley says Union County officials have already formed a committee to assess the potential impacts and needs for such a project, with the hope of receiving more information from their efforts.
They're comprised of people from the REC, CERWA, and a couple other places that are gathering information and facts and going to make a recommendation to their board, and they have said that they would be glad to share that information with us.
Standley adds representatives from another county raised questions and concerns about how data centers could be taxed. While no action was taken by the board this week, Standley says the moratorium would allow county officials to draft appropriate regulations and ordinances.
This is a little bit new for our area, and so that's before we just open the door and with no information. I think we're just trying to do our due diligence and be able to put together some information before, you know, something comes in and a project wants to move forward without having our ducks in a row.
Well, he's not aware of any proposed data centers in Adams County. Stanley says they want to be proactive rather than reactive. Further discussion and possible action at a data center moratorium in Adams County is expected at the board's regular meeting Monday. Pates County's five-year outlook of major road and bridge projects is set. By unanimous vote Tuesday, the county's Board of Supervisors approved the county's five-year program for fiscal year 2027, which begins July 1st. The plan is approved annually by the board, this year outlining projects along the county's roads through fiscal year 2031. County engineer J.D. King says the lone project currently slated for fiscal 27 is the Yorktown Bridge Replacement Project, which includes renovating two bridges over a creek southwest of Yorktown, replacing one, and constructing a new road south of the creek to connect east and west traffic.
This is a project hopefully we'll get let. Later this fall, we're in the process of acquiring right-of-way easements for fiscal year 2027.
For fiscal year 2028, King says plans call for replacing the Redwood Avenue Bridge over the Neely Branch, utilizing roughly $2.3 million in federal funds. In fiscal 28, King says they're targeting a base stabilization and seal coat of M56, or Juniper Avenue, from Highway 2 to J20 and M41, or D Avenue, north of J14 to 270th Street in Montgomery County.
We're going to take this all the way up to the Coburg Road, which includes a mile in Montgomery County. I've spoken with a Montgomery County engineer several times. We'll do the work, or we'll include it in our plans. And when the project's done, Montgomery County will write our farm market account a check, and we'll connect up Page County to the Coburg Road, which is a benefit to the traveling public.
Bridge projects also doubt the five-year plan throughout the future fiscal years, including the structure on 170th Street just west of M Avenue in 2028, a bridge on F Avenue just south of 230th Street, and C Avenue just south of 280th Street in 2029, a structure on M56 and 130th Street, and C Avenue just south of 290th Street in 2030, and along 170th Street just east of M56.
In Page County, between 1950 and 1965, Page County built 45 bridges. In other words, each year they built three. We built three bridges every year. We can't build three bridges every year. So there's a big glut of bridges this age, and we can't replace them all at the same time. So we start getting one here and there.
King says the bridge on F Avenue just south of 230th Street would allow the road to serve as a good connection between two major highways in the county. Given the plan is approved annually, King notes the five-year roadmap is subject to change as other projects or need arise. Lunch for Clarinda residents was on Iowa Western Community College Monday. Iowa Western officials celebrated the community support of the college over the years with a special Community Appreciation Day lunch at the school's Clarinda Center. Iowa Western President Dr. Daniel Kinney tells KMA News the event was part of the school's community outreach and to outline plans for the Clarinda Center's renovation.
Definitely what we've been doing really across the whole district itself has been doing a lot of upgrades. Here we've done some work in the Seams building, nursing in the last few years and things like that. And then this summer we'll be working on from the bond that was passed a few months ago, we'll be doing some renovations here. So we're really trying to, I think the big thing is thank the community for the support that they've given to Iowa Western, but also kind of show off our facilities and what we're doing.
Voters in Iowa Western's coverage area approved a $55 million bond issue in November of last year by more than 70% of the vote. Provisions from the bond issue included funding for renovations at the Clarinda Center.
We're going to be taking what would probably have been the old kind of CTE area. We're going to be giving it a facelift, updating it so we can put some additional classrooms into there to bring some high school programming into it. We haven't completely decided on the programming yet, but we'll be doing that. But not only here, we're doing over in Shenandoah too. At the Shenandoah Center, we're going to take out some of those original classrooms, turn them into more career technical education space, because that's where we're going.
Kinney says Iowa Western's goal is to offer more programming designed for students seeking a four-year degree closer to home. He says the Clarinda Center's enrollment has grown by 15% over the past few years. That wraps up this week in KMA Land. Be listening each week at this time for This Week in KMA Land. And for more information all the time, log on to KMALand.com, where you can also hear this program in its entirety. For the entire KMA News team, this is Mike Peterson. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. This week in KMA Land, a presentation of KMA News.